You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Normally, when you get a guest and they can't make it, you go, oh, well, and you speak to the production staff and you go, don't worry about it, we'll do it some other time, and you know, because it wasn't that important. However, as you know, or may not be aware, I am a petrol head par excellence. I get emotional when I sniff petrol, not I do it all the time. And when it was first mooted that I might get the chance to speak to Jason Plato, I bounced up and down on my spring like Zebedee. So, he's had a bit of trouble getting in because of some climate change protesters. Let's not go there. He's come from the underworld. World, otherwise known as probably the Northern Line. I mean, delighted to join me live from somewhere in Greater London, racing driver Jason Plato. Jason, good afternoon to you.
How are you doing, Charles?
Well, I'm doing better than you by the sounds of things. What on earth is going on over there?
It's great. We just had a busy day. That's all. We're in and out of London, you know, book PR, and obviously there's this demonstrations going on in town. But it's fine. We just have to find alternative methods of transport.
Absolutely.
I dumped my car somewhere in the middle of London. I don't know where, but I just dumped it.
Fair enough. And dumping your car in the middle of places, be it sort of Snetterton, Thruxton, Silverstone, or, you know, around the streets of Monaco, is something you've been quite known for. I mean, you won two championships, and you've decided to put this together in a book called How Not to Be a Professional Racing Driver. Now, in a world where we are always being told to get sponsorships, to be media friendly, to keep yourself whiter than white, Jason, this is a refreshing tome.
Well, do you know what? There's two blueprints to me. Of obviously how to do it, because I have. But you know what people want? I think they want to hear about the how not to, because I've made some pretty big gaffes and guffs and mistakes along the way. Most of them are humorous. An orthodox in that I don't toe the line. I'm a bit outspoken. I court the media and use it in certain ways.
Right.
And I'm a no holes barred kind of guy. And it was much more fun thinking about writing a book to tell that side of, you know, my career, if you like, than the other side. And you know, it's designed to make people giggle. All the stories are, you know, real events, and most of them are kind of pointing fun at myself, which is great.
For those who don't know who you are, and I know you from following in the Tin Top days, I mean, how did it all start, Jason? Where did it all start going right? And then, you know, and how did you, because I mean, you won the championship, you won the touring car championship on several occasions in your BRDC. So explain a little about how you got into motor racing.
What, from the very beginning, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, tell me about your childhood.
Well, do you know what? It did, you know, my dad was a motor dealer, and so, you know, cars had always been, you know, a love of mine, a love of my dad's. And, you know, when I was I was 11, someone owed him a few hundred quid and didn't pay him. And he basically said, well, look, instead of giving me the readies, can I have that racing car? And it was an old, really old BM chassis with a Bolteco engine. I mean, a late 1970s kind of thing. And that was basically a toy for my old man to mess around on the weekends. And And I managed to persuade him to let me have a go. And first off, this was around the petrol pumps on a Sunday when the garage was shut. You know, it was like a chain across the inn and a chain across the out. And we used to fly around the petrol pumps. And then we found a local car park at, you know, Tyne Car Auctions in Newcastle, where obviously my old man knew the guy who owned it. And we got to go and play in the evenings. And it just spiraled from there. You know, it was something which, as a family, we all love to do. And within a matter of months of, you know, me getting in this thing, we'd gone and got a van and we were charging up and down the UK nearly every weekend going racing. And it was me, my mum, my dad, and our dog called Castrol. And you know, to live in this little tiny van, you know, I helped my dad build a partition in it and we got out some foam cut. And the three of us used to bed down in, you know, the middle of Barnsley or in Somerset and go racing like many, you know, all the parents and this community of carters. That's what we did. And it was our life and we loved it.
So when did you decide, when was it apparent that you actually had a bit of skill in flinging a kart around a track and you made the move? Because you didn't spring fully formed from karting into tin tops, did you? Presumably you did some formula stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we started to win pretty much straight away in karting. And then we won the club championships. I was brought up in Newcastle and it was a great kart, something called Southampton in Northumberland. And we won the club championships and we started competing nationally. And we, you know, kit got better, we got better deals, drove for better teams. But, you know, I'd always had my sights set on F1. And, you know, we're successful in karting at both the national and international level. But, you know, I stopped karting in 87. And the void between karting and going into single-seaters was huge back then, less so now. So I took a couple of years to try and meet and find the sponsors. You know, this was kind of the late 80s. And then enrolled myself in a Winfield racing school in France. Did that. And that kind of was the catapult, actually. That was the springboard where it enabled me to meet, you know, some key people at Renault who, you know, I've been very successful with and they've played a huge role in my career. And that kind of got me on the single-seater ladder. But, you know, I started off in Formula Renault and was being tipped for great things. But like so many other drivers, I just didn't have the backing to get to F1. And, you know, now looking back, I'm over that. I'm over not making.
Sorry to bring it up again, Jason. Sorry about that, yeah.
Yeah, I think I had the ability. But looking back, would I have been clean cut enough and disciplined enough? I doubt, actually, because, you know, the way I, you know, I run my life and career, that's probably doesn't sit harmonious with how the industry was back then.
Yeah.
I like to go out, I like to have fun. You know, my mantra is, you know, if you're going to get wet, you may as well go swimming. And you know, when today's gone, it's gone, it ain't coming back. And that's how I run my life. So I'm flat out at everything, whether that be having fun or racing or selling things or presenting on TV. But I don't think I would have been disciplined enough. I certainly could have driven the cars fast enough, but yeah, going down the gym, that doesn't sit nicely with me.
And also,
I don't like the gym.
If you think about, you know, British touring cars, which you've won more races than anyone else in the history of it. If you think about the great touring car races of our time, Tim Harvey, you know, Steve Soper, John Cleland. Yeah. Steve Soper and John Cleland famously had that accident at Silverstone, which went on for about five corners.
Yeah. Do you know what? And I'm very good friends with Steve, actually. And I can remember I was working at Silverstone at a racing school in the mid-90s when my single-seater career had stalled. And I was thinking, right, where do I go from here? And I was, you know, it was a BMW PR day. And I managed to, as an instructor, managed to, you know, to somehow get a passenger ride with Steve. And, you know, he was in his day sublime. As a race driver, and that kind of was a catalyst actually for me thinking, oh, on this touring car stuff's good news.
So you go into touring cars and the rest of say is kind of history. You became a touring car legend, like I said. Was it 90 something victories in touring car?
Yeah 97.
You won it twice and you found yourself not only winning on a regular basis, but you got yourself into the media as well.
Well, do you know what? Interesting enough, when you know it all started with me with touring cars, in '96 I did a Renault Spider Championship, and that was my good friends at Renault said, "Look, JP, you know your single seat career is stalled; it's potentially over, and this is a risky move for you. But we've got this new little sports car series called the Renault Spider Cup. Do you want to come and have a go at that?" But from my perspective, it was a big risk because it was most definitely sideways from where I was and backwards, actually. And there was potentially nothing to gain from it because, I would have been expected to win. Anyway, I embraced it for one good reason. That was the winner of the Chad Championship was given a test with Williams Renault in their touring car. And I knew that Will Hoy was retiring, God bless him, with us, but I know he was retiring at the end of the 96 season. So actually there was potential for a hole. So, to cut a long story short, I won the Spider Series, did a test with Williams, went down, had the interview with Frank and Patrick Head, and then about a week later was given the news that, look, unfortunately, Jason, you did a great test, couldn't have done any more. We're going to go with an XF1 driver. We need someone with a profile. And, that was a big lesson. Because it made me think, hold on, the profile thing's important, which is one of the reasons why I got into TV. But also, about a couple of weeks after that, I woke up full of hell one morning and thought, I'm just not having this. So I got down to Williams to go and see Frank and basically tell him, mate, you're making a big mistake here. You need to give the drive to me. Anyway, but because previous weeks I'd met, when I went down there to meet Frank for the first time, I'd befriended the security guards and the girls on reception. So I got through the system, and I was in. And then Nicola, Frank's PA, scary Nicola, came down after about 15 minutes of reception and said, look, what on earth do you think you're doing? You just can't walk in off the streets and, demand to see Frank.
Yeah.
He's a busy bloke. Anyway, argued. And it was getting nowhere. And then Nicola let a gem of information out, which was, look, you're wasting your time. He won't be here until 12:30. And that gave me an opportunity. Now, I don't know if I said that on purpose or it slipped out, but nevertheless, it gave me a chance to recoil back to my bunker outside.
Right.
And I went back out. This was about 9:30. And then I camped in the car park. I moved my car two or three times, hid it under a tree, and sat and waited. And when he arrived, I ran after his car and basically begged and pleaded for 5 minutes of his time. And he did give me 5 minutes of his time. He kept me outside his office for 40 minutes, mind the stinker.
Right.
And, I smoked myself to oblivion whilst I was outside waiting for him. But nevertheless, I got 5 minutes of his time, and, I banged on his desk and said, look, please, Frank, give me a chance. And do you know what? I left there totally content that I'd done everything. And if it came my way, if it didn't, there was nothing more I could have done. And that moment was, that's it. Me and motor racing are done. If this doesn't come off, I've reached that point where nothing was going right. And I got a phone call a week later from Frank saying, look, Jason, we're going to do a test. It's you, Johnny Daddy, and Jean-Christophe Boulin, our test driver in Formula 1. We're going to do a test at Snetterton. You're each going to get the same equipment. Each going to get the same amount of time in the car, the same amount of tyres. Fastest man gets the job. And here we are.
Brilliant.
And that's how it all started.
Brilliant.
And do you know what? It changed my life that morning. Completely changed my life. And within a week, well, within 2 or 3 days of being called, of getting the news, or doing the test, I was called down to see Frank. Still didn't know what was going to go on. I was half expecting that he did a great job, but no thanks. And a 3-year contract was thrown across the desk, and he wanted me to sign it there and then. And I'm like, well, hold on, I need to look at this. No, you don't. You just need to sign it. And then we started negotiating. It was a great moment. But to get back to your point, that resonated with me about, they're going after some drivers with profile. So I actively went out and tried to pursue some opportunities in TV because I thought, I can do the bit in the car, but I don't ever want to be let down by not having the right profile. And hence, that's where, Yeah. Originally, Driven came from on Channel 5, and then obviously in later years off to Fifth Gear. So all quite strategic. And this was whilst trying to circumnavigate the boozer as well, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my father was a professional racing driver in the 60s and the 70s, and he tells tales of what went on, between races at Spa and the murmuring and that sort of thing. You ever thought you were sort of a bit of a throwback to those times, Jason?
Possibly. James, he was a great hero of mine,
yeah.
As were, lots of drivers from that era. But do you know what? It's just who I am. I don't pull any punches. I say what I see. And if I don't like things, I'll say it. I'm a bit of a Marmite-y sort of character. If I was ever getting a bollocking at school, then I'd look at them in the eye, and that didn't earn me friends with a few teachers. It earned me some friends with some others. But so I've always done it my way, and like I said earlier, when the day's gone, it is gone. And if there's an opportunity to have some fun, then why not?
I mean, in the book, there are quite a few examples of this, including stealing a JCB in Monaco and ending up in prison there twice. That's quite an affair. That's quite a good affair. Was this during Grand Prix week or just a normal sort of... No, I was going to say.
No, it wasn't. I lived down there for a few years, and outside my apartment was on the fifth floor on the start-finish straight, so I looked out straight to the port, and whilst I'd be redoing the pit complex, it was a bit of a building site. And me and a couple of my pals had come out of Raskas Bar, and then we were walking alongside the building site. So the JCB wasn't on the road, and
right.
And no one leaves, no one locks anything up down there because it's so safe. And I thought, I just couldn't see if the keys are in it, and they were. So I got the thing started up, and then started to pull some levers, trying to dig a hole or something.
Right,
and within a nanosecond, I was on my backside on the floor, being arrested by the robbers, of which they then put me in jail for the night. And the nice thing is, they're very friendly. It's a very nice jail. And you get a coffee and a croissant in the morning, and then they came along with a breathalyzer. And I'm like, no, I wasn't driving it.
Yeah.
No, it's fine. You just can't leave here until you're absolutely zero on the breath meter. My dad didn't let me out till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was literally 50 yards from my apartment. I'm like, oh, come on, lads, just let me... No, wait until you're sober.
Nightmare.
So, all hygiene, just buffoonerism.
And I mean, the one man who you shouldn't cross in any form of motorsport is Bernie. You had a run-in with Bernie.
Well, do you know what? Had I one more station or searched for one more station on my car stereo, I would have changed motorsport forever. Because in 1997, I was coming out of London down the Brompton Road on a Sunday morning to go and do some PR for Renault. And I was, it was early. It was like probably 7:30, something like that. Wasn't really totally awake or alert. And I was tuning the stereo, and then I looked up, and Bernie was on a zebra crossing. And I had to slam on the anchors. And I only just stopped. I mean, properly... stopped with a foot spare, and had I gone for another radio, I would have taken him out. I would have hit him at 40 mile an hour, I could have killed him.
Yeah.
Could you imagine what would have happened? How motorsport would have the world of motorsport would have changed. Thankfully, I didn't.
Did he recognise you, Jason? Is the question, because if he did, you might have wanted to kill him.
Well, do you know what? I was in Renault team kit, and I was horrified. You know what? I've subsequently obviously met Bernie and said, "Do you remember that?" And he kind of doesn't. So I got away with it.
And also, there's a thing in the book. I mean, making enemies. I don't know if you can name this enemy, because I'm going to ask who's the most fun to hang out with in touring cars. But a 6'6" rival who's a black belt and everything. This isn't Johnny Herbert, is it?
No, it's not. It's one of my nemesis is, we've had great rivalry over the years, and that's Matt Neal.
Matt Neal, yeah.
We've had some proper dingles.
Yeah.
And And in many ways, you know, even though we don't see eye to eye on a lot of stuff, and you know, back in those days, back in the mid-noughties, you know, we didn't get on. I mean, we would struggle to even speak. You know, it was not a good relationship. I mean, we hated each other. And it's less so now, but it was genuine dislike and distrust. And because we were both at the sharp end of the grid all the time, you know, it was pretty, you know, there was a lot of aggro on track and a lot of dirty drinks and a lot of out-psyching. And also, you know, we you know, Tour of Touring Cars kind of revolved around us, so it was good for business for us to have a bit of a spat. And actually, we courted it a little bit. But, you know, needless to say, nowadays we are somewhat more mellowed, but
yeah,
I still think, I mean, there's still, I mean, we don't get on. We're civil, but we don't get on. But do you see, I'm like that with all my competitors, because I'm not there to make friends. It's my work. I'm there to win, and they are the enemy. So I don't see the point in trying to have some, you know, make-believe, superficial friendship, which as soon as your back's turned, you're going to get a knife between your shoulder blades. And I kind of treat them all with absolute disdain. That's not to say I'm not courteous, but it's a job. So yeah, I've had run-ins with quite a few drivers over the years.
And you also gave our future king the finger as well.
Yes, that wasn't one of my best moments.
Understatement of the year there.
Well, do you know what? Do I suffer from road rage? Not really, but I'm not one to be messed with on the road. If I'm doing something wrong, then of course I'll accept, you know, any abuse which is thrown my way. But when I'm just minding my own business on the M3 on a Sunday morning, going somewhere, doing a little more than 70, it has to be said, and I'm in the fast lane overtaking cars, and when a big Range Rover comes up behind you and starts flashing the lights and almost trying to get into your boot, then I take umbrage to that. And there was a little brake test, but that had the desired effect that you could pull back a little bit. But then I see it just kept on flashing, and in the end I thought, I just can't be bothered with this. So I pulled over and timed my middle finger and my mouth to F and blind as it came alongside, just to demonstrate how distasteful I thought his particular road style was. Only as my fingers came up visible and the words started to come out of my mouth, I thought, there was someone in the passenger that I reckon, oh my God, and it was Prince Charles. And he looked at me with a mixture of horror and amusement. And he kept on, and as he was kind of smirking, he kept on, and as I then his driver drive past, he kind of kept on turning his head to have a look at me. Because my reaction to him must have been hilarious. Yeah, and I'm dying to meet him, because I'm sure he'll remember it, because I don't know as many people have told Prince Charles to F off.
It's just the close protection officer with him didn't shoot you.
Thrown in the dungeon of the Tower of London.
I was about to say that. So who approached you to write this book? I mean, it seems to have written itself, to be honest with you, Jason.
Well, do you know, I've always kind of had it on the back burner in my mind as something I'd like to do. And it all came about, I've spoken to writers over the years, and I never really pushed it further, because it was something I wanted to do when I retired. But then there's a good pal of mine, Dougie Lampkin, you know, the trials right writer.
I interviewed Dougie a couple of months ago.
Yeah, he's lush and he's such a great bloke. He said, look, I've just written a book, and the guy which has helped me really wants to speak to you. He knows all about you. He's done his homework. Do you want to have a chat with him? And I did. And he was a northerner, you know, like me. He was a Yorkshire lad. And we just got on really well. And I said, well, look, why don't we get together? We'll write a little pitch document. We'll write, say, half a chapter as a teaser. And let's see if we can make it spin. Within a day of it hitting the publishing rounds, you know, the best publisher in the business jumped out of the woodwork and loved it. And within, you know, this was at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and by four we agreed terms. So, yeah, it's been a really interesting project to do, you know, A, remembering all the stories, but B, trying to you know, put a framework around them. Well, what we didn't want to do with the book was you know, it's not a chronology of dates and in this year. And we just wanted to chuck a load of stories in there, which are mostly self-deprecating and things I've screwed up with along the way.
Yeah.
And some good things too. And just make people giggle and give them a little bit of an insight about what goes on in my particularly crazy mind and even more particularly crazy life. So we've kind of assembled it as a mismatch of lessons of what not to do. And it's been great fun to do it, I must admit. It's been really great.
What has been, what's the circuit? Because everybody says, oh, I love the British fans and I love, you know, Silverstone is, you know, where the clubhouse is and that sort of stuff, and Alton Park's wonderful and this, that. What's the place that you've ever gone to? It doesn't have to, you don't have to be sort of like, you know, to Britain, but, you know, racing worldwide. I mean, you just thought, oh, you know, it's always jinxed you. Have you all thought, I can't wait to get out of this place?
Well, I can remember going to Silverstone for the very first time with my dad to watch a Grand Prix there when I was a kid. And I can remember going in there and just thinking, oh my word, this is just an amazing place. And interestingly enough, now I sit on the main board of directors of the British Race Drivers Club, who own Silverstone. So the management team effectively work for us. So,
yeah.
So now, you know, I'm one of six directors at Silverstone. And it still gives me a funny feeling when I go through the gates, because it's an amazing place. It, you know, it's steeped in history. But from a driving perspective, I remember the first time I went over to Bathurst in Australia, and I can remember watching that race with my dad on the sofa as a kid, watching like their Jaguar XJSs ran around there, and I used to work TBR in the summer holidays when I was a kid, doing, you know, as a gopher on the race team, going, like hanging out pit boards and making tea and washing cars, all that sort of stuff. And watching those guys tear ass round Mount Panorama, Bathurst Circuit, and then when I got the chance to go down there and race in first time was 97, I mean, that was an amazing moment to, you know, to be on a piece of tarmac, and there's a bit over the top at Skyline when you go over what they call the Dipper. I remember I had the team manager in the front seat, Alan Jones, Formula One world champion Williams driver, who was our teammate. He was driving in the number two car. I was driving with Manu in the number one car. And he was driving, and me and Alan Manu were in the back. And I can remember he gave us a bit of a guided tour on the circuit. I can remember looking over through the centre between the front seats as we went over the Dipper. And I thought to myself, that's not a racetrack. That's a roller coaster ride. And it is insane. I mean, it's insane. And, I can remember, I just loved it. I mean, I ended up getting the lap record right there, which still stands to this day. And we and Alan were leading the race by a country mile until our car broke. It was 1,000 kilometre, two-driver race. But what a piece of tarmac.
Yeah.
It's just the most amazing race circuit. And it, you know, it's a street circuit, but it's kind of, it is public roads, but it goes over the top of the mountain downhill side. I mean, it's epic. So yeah, as a piece of tarmac, as a road, that, but as a place which gets your hairs on end, is most certainly Silverstone.
And you're still racing, you're still doing it. You were still getting upset with stewards as well. I saw, looking at some of the recent stuff in the press. So still, obviously, still loving it, Jason.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've had two really grim years. There's a bit going on behind the scenes about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I came under quite a lot of flack, actually, because there was, you know, I was uncompetitive, and one of the cars on the team was competitive, and I wasn't. And, you know, there was lots of calls, oh, you just passed it, yada, yada, yada. And I knew deep down inside that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it was awful going to the circuits knowing that I'm not going to be competitive. And so, arose, and, first race this year in a different team, bang, on the front row again. And along with being competitive again, obviously comes with that, hand in hand with that, is trips to the steward's bus, because, you know, if there's a gap, I go for it. That's how I race, and that's probably why I've won more races than anybody else by a long chalk, but also probably why I haven't won, why there's not more than two championships to my name. I mean, there should be another three or four, but because I go for the win all the time rather than thinking, oh, I just play the long game, I'll play second's good enough.
Yeah.
That's not in my fibre. It's not in my psyche
to settle.
And it would have served me better for championships, but would have served me not as well for race wins. And yeah, when I go to win.
But Jason, I mean, honestly, when your name came across, flashed across my desk, I was like, absolutely, I have to interview Jason Plater because you do have a huge fan base. There's a storm coming across the Mediterranean, believe it or not, and it's mucking up the phone line I'm getting with you. So I'm gonna. I know. That's the Neil family doing the stuff.
It's quite nice at the minute in the UK. The sun's shining, which is all right.
The climate protesters are sunning themselves. Fantastic. The book the book is called How Not to Be a Professional Racing Driver. It's out now on Michael Joseph. It's by Jason Plater. Jason, if people want to follow you online, they can find you all over the shop, I should imagine.
I use Twitter a lot. I don't do the book face or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Like, it's instant. So, yeah, at Jason Plater is a good. But yeah, I highly recommend the book. It's in all formats. You know, I did the audio read for the audio book. I narrated it.
Oh, it's an audio book as well. Fantastic.
As well, yeah. I mean, that was 3 days of my life, which were really very difficult actually to sit in a studio and just read your book. It was very tricky, but it's thoroughly enjoyable. But yeah, I highly recommend it because it will make you giggle.
Well,
and life's stressful enough. So, yeah, get out, get the book, and crack yourself a tinny open, or even better, have a G&T whilst reading it.
Marvellous. Jason, the book is highly enjoyable. This interview has been more than highly enjoyable. Jason Plater, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right Rug.